Mary Thornquist did not know that the man who had watched her stitch winter cloaks for 3 weeks straight was a king. She did not know his carriage already stood waiting in the snow beyond the Tradetown gate. Horses steaming in the cold, a fur-lined seat empty and meant for her. She only knew that the man she had given 6 years of her life to had just laughed at her in front of the whole common hall, and that the laugh had landed somewhere beneath her ribs and stayed there, burning. The fire in the hearth popped. Snow ticked against the shutters of Hollowfrost Crossing like fingers asking to come in. "Go on, then," Garrick said, leaning back against the long trestle table with his arms crossed and his mouth curled. The other men around him were grinning into their cups, waiting to see what she would do. "You're leaving? With what, Mary? Your needles?" He looked at the small bundle in her arms, the one she had packed in the dark before dawn, and he laughed again. It was a warm, easy laugh, the kind that had once made her feel safe. Now it scraped. "Where exactly does a seamstress go in the dead of winter?" Her hands were steady. She noticed that, distantly, the way a person notices the weather during a moment too large to feel all at once. Her hands were steady, even though everything underneath them was shaking. "Anywhere that isn't here," she said. That set the table laughing harder. Mary Thornquist was 26 years old, and for 6 of those years she had believed that Garrick Vane was her mate. Not because the bond had ever hummed the way the old women said it should. Not because she had ever felt the golden thread the songs described, the one that was supposed to pull two destined souls toward each other across any distance. She had believed it because he had told her so when she was 20 and grieving her mother, and because believing it had been easier than being alone. She knew now, standing in the doorway with snow at her back and laughter in her face, that she had built 6 years on a sentence a man had said to keep a willing girl close. She turned and walked out into the white. The cold took her breath the way grief takes it, all at once and without permission. Hollowfrost Crossing sat high in the mountains where the trade roads met, a cluster of stone and timber buildings huddled together against the wind, smoke rising from every chimney in thin gray ropes. By daylight, it was a place of bargains and bundled furs and the constant ring of the smith's hammer. Tonight, well past dark, it was empty and shining, every surface furred with new snow, the lanterns at the corners throwing small warm circles that did nothing against the larger dark. She pulled her cream shawl tighter over her faded blue dress and put one foot in front of the other. She did not cry. She had decided that much before she walked out. She would not give them her tears to laugh at. She would walk to the gate and past the gate, and she would figure out the rest of her life when the town was behind her and no one could see her face. She made it perhaps 30 steps before her legs began to understand what the rest of her had not yet admitted. She had nowhere to go. The next town was 2 days' walk through a mountain pass that swallowed travelers whole this time of year. She had a bundle of thread and 3 copper coins and a winter coming down around her shoulders like an answer to a question she had been afraid to ask. The gate rose ahead of her, dark timber bound in iron, the wolf's head carved into the lintel almost lost under snow. And beyond it, in the road, a carriage. She stopped. It was a beautiful thing, black lacquered and gleaming, 2 gray horses harnessed before it with their breath rising in great plumes. A driver sat hunched on the bench in a heavy cloak, and standing beside the open door, perfectly still, as if he had been waiting there a long time and intended to wait longer if he had to, was a man. He was tall. That was the first thing she understood about him, the way the night seemed to organize itself around his shoulders. He wore a dark green leather jerkin and a black fur mantle that moved when the wind moved, and his hair was black, swept back from his face with 1 thin braid woven at the temple in the old warrior fashion. His eyes, when they found her, were the gray of a sky about to break open. She had seen those eyes before. She realized it slowly, The way you realize the shape in the corner of a dark room is a person and not a coat. She had seen them across the common hall for 3 weeks, belonging to a quiet traveler who came in from the cold each evening, ordered nothing, and watched her work her needle by the fire. She had thought he was a merchant waiting out the weather. "You're cold," he said. His voice was low and unhurried, and it carried across the snow without effort. "Get in. The seat is warm." Mary's heart was hammering. She did not move. "I don't know you," she said. "No." Something flickered at the corner of his mouth. Not quite a smile. "But I know you. Mary Thornquist. You sew a double seam where the others sew single because you've buried too many travelers who froze through a cheap stitch. You hum when you don't know you're doing it. You gave your last bread to the Ackerley girl on the third night I watched you, and you told her it was because you weren't hungry, which was a lie, because your hand shook when you set the bowl down." He paused. "I have watched a great many people in my life. I have never watched anyone the way I watched you." The wind moved between them. Snow gathered on his shoulders, and he did not brush it away. "Why?" she managed. "Because the moment I saw you," he said, "something in me went still that has not been still in a long time. I did not understand it. I am not a man who is often confused. So I stayed. And I watched. And I waited to be wrong about it." His gray eyes did not leave her face. "I have not been wrong about it." She should have been afraid. A strange man. A waiting carriage. A road in the dark. Every story her mother had told her began this way, as a warning. But the thing humming low in her chest was not fear. It was the thread. The one from the songs. The one she had spent 6 years pretending not to notice was absent, because the absence had been proof of something she did not want to know. It was here now. It was singing. "I just left a man who told me I was his mate," she said, and her voice cracked on the last word despite everything. "For 6 years. I believed him for 6 years. "I know," Edric said. "I heard him laugh." Her chin came up. "He will not laugh again," the king said, and there was nothing loud in it, nothing performed, only a flat certainty that made the hair rise on her arms. "Not where you can hear it. Get in the carriage, Mary. You don't have to know me yet. You only have to be warm tonight." She looked back at the town once. The hall windows glowed gold and small behind her, full of men who had laughed. Ahead of her was a stranger and a road and a cold that would kill her if she chose it out of pride. She got in the carriage. The seat was warm, as he had said. A heated stone wrapped in wool sat on the floor, and a fur lay folded for her lap. And she understood as she sank into it that the warmth had been waiting for her specifically, prepared by someone who had known she would come walking out into the snow with nothing. He climbed in across from her and shut the door, and the carriage rocked forward, and Hollowfrost Crossing began to slide away behind them into the white. For a long while, neither of them spoke. She watched his hands, which were large and scarred and very still on his knees. She watched the line of his jaw in the dark. "You never told me your name?" she said at last. "Edric," he said. "Just Edric." His gray eyes moved to her, and for the first time, something in his face softened, became almost rueful. "Not just Edric," he admitted, "but the rest can wait until you've slept and eaten and stopped shivering. The rest changes how you'll look at me, and I would like one night where you look at me the way you're looking at me now." "And how am I looking at you?" "Like a person," he said quietly. "Not a position." She did not understand it then. She would. By morning. They traveled through the night. He gave her bread and dried apples from a basket, and she ate more than she meant to. And he watched her eat with a focus that should have unnerved her, and instead made her feel, absurdly, cared for. When her eyes grew heavy, he told her to sleep, and she said she would not sleep in a stranger's carriage. And then she slept anyway, and woke once near dawn to find the fur tucked higher around her shoulders than she had left it, and Edric awake across from her, watching the dark pass, keeping some quiet vigil she did not understand. The carriage stopped at first light. Mary woke fully and looked out the window and forgot how to breathe. They had come down out of the high passes into a wide white valley, and across that valley, rising against the dawn, stood a fortress. Not a manor. Not a keep. A great gray citadel of stone and timber, banners snapping from its towers, each one bearing a golden wolf on a field of green. Smoke rose from 100 chimneys. Riders moved on the road below it, and every banner, every wall, every armed figure she could see bore the same emblem stitched in gold. The same emblem that gleamed, she realized slowly, on the breast of Edric's jerkin. She turned to look at him. He was already watching her, his expression careful, braced. "You're him," she said. Her voice came out very small. "You're the Alpha King." "I am," Edric Hawthorne said. The thread in her chest did not snap. She had expected it to snap. Instead, it pulled tight, almost painfully, as if the truth had only made it stronger. "You watched me sew cloaks," she said, "for 3 weeks. You sat by the fire in a common hall and ordered nothing. You're the king of the whole Northern Reach, and you sat on a wooden bench and watched a seamstress for 3 weeks." "Yes." "Why didn't you tell me?" "Because the moment I told you," he said, "you would have stopped being Mary and started being a woman talking to a king. I have spent my whole life watching people become something false the instant they learn what I am. I did not want that from you. I wanted 3 weeks of you being only yourself, even if you never knew you'd given them to me." He looked out at his own citadel as if it were a thing that had been hung around his neck. "It was selfish. I know it was. But I have so little that is real." She should have been angry. Part of her was. But under the anger was the memory of his hand tucking the fur higher while she slept, and the heated stone waiting on the carriage floor, and 3 weeks of a king sitting silent by a fire because a woman with a needle had made something in him go still. "I don't know how to be a queen," she said. "I didn't ask you to be a queen," Edric said. "I asked you to be warm tonight. The rest, we decide together, slowly. And only if you want it. If you want to go home in the spring, I will take you home in the spring, and you will never see me again, and I will count the 3 weeks as the richest of my life." His gray eyes held hers. "But I hope you'll stay long enough to learn that I am the same man who watched you by the fire. The crown doesn't change him. It only makes him lonelier." The carriage rolled on toward the great gray walls, and Mary Thornquist, who had walked out of one life into the snow with 3 copper coins and a bundle of thread, rode into another with her heart pulling on a thread she no longer had to pretend wasn't there. The first days in the citadel were strange and slow. Edric gave her rooms warmer than any she had known, and clothes finer than any she had sewn, and a kindness that asked nothing back. He did not crowd her. He took meals with her when she wanted company and left her alone when she did not. He showed her the citadel as if it were a thing he was a little embarrassed by, naming the long-dead Hawthorne kings whose portraits glowered down the great gallery, telling her which of them had been cruel and which merely sad, until she understood that he had grown up in this stone place very much alone. On the second night, she could not sleep, and she rose and wandered the cold halls in a borrowed robe, and she found that the citadel was a quiet place after dark, full of the small sounds of stone settling and wind finding the gaps. She came to a window and stood looking out at the white valley, and she thought about the common hall and the laughter, and how strange it was that a thing could break you and free you in the same breath. She did not hear him come. She only felt the warmth at her back, and turned, and found Edric standing a careful distance away, with a candle in his hand. "You don't sleep either," she said. I never have, he said. A king learns to mistrust the dark. Too many men have ended in it. He came to stand beside her at the window, leaving space between them, always leaving space. What keeps you awake? I keep thinking I should feel worse, she admitted. 6 years, and I walked out. And I should be grieving, and I'm not. I just feel light. Like I set down something I'd been carrying so long I forgot it was heavy. She looked at him. Is that wrong? No, Edric said. It's the truest thing you've told me. He was quiet a moment. Grief is for what you lose. You didn't lose anything in that hall. You found out you'd never had it. That isn't grief. That's waking up. She thought about that for a long time after he had gone, and she slept. Finally, better than she had slept in years. She met Ren on the third day. The girl could not have been more than 14, all elbows and quick dark eyes. A kitchen apprentice who had been given the task of carrying Mary's washing and had decided, somewhere in the carrying, to attach herself to Mary entirely. Ren Ackerley had a sister back in Hollowfrost Crossing, she said. The little one Mary had given her bread to. Word had traveled the trade roads faster than the carriage. The seamstress who had walked out laughing into the snow and been carried off by the king himself was already a story the children told. They say he's frightening, Ren confided, sitting cross-legged on the floor while Mary mended a torn sleeve out of pure habit because her hands did not know how to be idle. The kitchen women, they say the Alpha King's never smiled once in all his life, and his heart's a stone. Mary thought of the fur tucked higher in the night, of a man saying, I would like one night where you look at me the way you're looking at me now. He's not frightening, she said. He's lonely. People mix the two up. The thread between them grew in those quiet days in a way the songs had never quite captured. It was not a lightning strike. It was the way she began to listen for his step in the gallery. It was the way he started leaving the door to his study open when he worked, not asking her in, only making it possible. It was the evening she found him there, bent over the ledgers of a kingdom, and sat down across from him without a word, and began to sew. And he looked up, and something in his face came undone, and neither of them said anything at all because nothing needed saying. You're humming, he said after a while. She had not known she was. My mother used to hum, she said, when she worked. I think I'd do it to keep her with me. She pulled her thread through and did not look up. She'd have liked you. She always said the loud men were the ones to fear and the quiet ones were the ones to watch. And which am I? Quiet, Mary said. I'm watching. The corner of his mouth lifted. It was not much of a smile, but it was the first she had seen, and she understood looking at it that she had been wrong about which of them was the rescuer. He had pulled her out of the snow, but she was pulling him out of something older and colder, and he knew it, and it terrified him more than any enemy ever had. The kiss came on the seventh night. A storm had rolled down out of the high passes, the same kind of storm that would have killed her on the road, and the citadel groaned around them in the wind. She could not sleep. She found him in the great gallery, alone, looking up at the portrait of a hard-faced man with the same gray eyes. My father, he said without turning. He told me a king could not afford to want anything, because anything you want can be used against you. He died believing it. He died alone in this room. He finally looked at her, and the stormlight moved across his face. I have spent my whole life proving him right. And then a woman in a faded blue dress hummed by a fire. And I wanted something for the first time in 30 years. And I have been so afraid, Mary. I am not a man who is often afraid. I am afraid all the time now. She crossed the gallery to him. I left a man who told me I was his mate for 6 years and never once felt this, she said. Her voice was shaking. His was steady now, and hers was shaking, and somewhere in the last 7 days they had traded the trembling between them. I felt nothing for 6 years, and I called it love because I didn't know there was anything else. And then I walked into the snow to die rather than stay one more night. And you were already there. You were already waiting, like the world knew before I did. It did, Edric said. I think it did. She kissed him. She had decided that much before she crossed the room, the way she had decided not to cry 7 nights ago, choosing it before her courage could catch up. She rose onto her toes and took his face in both her hands, calloused fingers against a king's jaw, and she kissed him. And the thread that had hummed and pulled and sung for 7 days went taut and bright and snapped into place like a key turning in a lock she had not known was on her own heart. He made a low sound against her mouth, something broken and grateful, and his arms came around her at last, careful and then not careful, gathering her in as if she might be taken from him. When they parted, his forehead came down to rest against hers, and they breathed the same breath in the stormlight, and neither of them let go. I have you, he said, very low. It was not possession, it was disbelief. After 30 years, I have you. You have me, she said. They might have stayed in that quiet a long while, but the storm was not the only thing that had come down out of the mountains. Word reached the Citadel 2 days later that a delegation had arrived from Hollowfrost Crossing, come to petition the king. Edric took such petitions in the Great Hall, as kings did, seated beneath the wolf banners with his council around him. Mary stood to the side where the king's companion stood, in a green gown she had helped sew herself, her chestnut hair down in the loose waves she had never bothered to pin. The doors opened. The delegation came in, snow still on their shoulders. Garrick was among them. She had not expected the lurch in her chest, the old animal flinch at the sight of him. He had come dressed in his finest, which was poor enough beside the Citadel's stone, and he was already smiling the easy smile, already shaping himself for the room. He had come, she understood at once, to claim a connection to the woman the king had taken. He had come to turn 6 years of her quiet life into a story that made him important. Your Majesty, he said, bowing low, I've come a long road. The woman in your hall? The seamstress, Mary Thornquist. She was promised to me. 6 years we were bonded before she ran off into the snow. I've come to set the matter right. The hall went quiet. Edric did not move. His gray eyes were very flat. Very still, the eyes of the man who had said he will not laugh again with such terrible calm. And Mary, who had walked out of one life and into another, who had been laughed at in a common hall, and had vowed never again to give a man like this her tears, stepped forward before the king could speak. I'll set it right, she said. Edric's gaze flicked to her. She felt it. She did not look at him. She kept her eyes on Garrick, and she found, to her surprise, that her hands were steady again, steady the way they had been in the doorway, the calm that comes when the worst has already happened and there is nothing left to be afraid of. You told me I was your mate, she said. Her voice carried the length of the silent hall. When I was 20 and my mother was 3 days buried and I would have believed anything that made the loneliness smaller, you told me I was your mate. And there was never any bond. And you knew there was never any bond. And you let me build my whole life on it because a girl who thinks she's bound to you is a girl who'll cook and clean and sew and never ask for more. She took a breath. I never felt the thread with you. Not once in 6 years. I felt nothing. And I called it love because you'd made sure I didn't know there was anything else to feel. Garrick's smile was slipping. Mary, this isn't the place to air old grievances. You're embarrassing yourself in front of the king. The king, Mary said, watched me sew cloaks for 3 weeks in your common hall, and you never once noticed a stranger by the fire, because you never once looked at me long enough to notice anything. Her voice did not rise. It did not need to. You laughed when I left, The whole hall laughed. Do you remember? You asked where a seamstress goes in the dead of winter. She let the silence stretch. She goes here. She walks out of your laughter into the snow, and the world that you never believed in is already waiting for her with the door open and the seat warm. That's where she goes. She heard behind her the smallest sound. Edric had risen. You were promised nothing, the king said, and his voice filled the hall the way the cold had filled the road, complete and inescapable. There was no bond. You knew it, and you used a grieving girl's loneliness against her for 6 years, and then you laughed her into a storm that should have killed her. You've come here expecting a reward for it. He came down the dais, slow, every eye in the hall on him. Instead, you'll go back the way you came. Today, before the next storm closes the pass. And you'll tell everyone in Hollowfrost Crossing exactly what you did, in your own words, so that no other girl in that town ever mistakes your kind of man for the kind worth waiting for. You'll do it because if I hear that you've shaped this into a story where you are anything but a small man who lied, I will come to Hollowfrost Crossing myself. And I am not a man you want to make come looking. Garrick had gone gray. He looked from the king to Mary and found, in both faces, the same unhurried certainty, and whatever he had come to take, he understood at last he would not be taking. Get him a fresh horse, Edric told the guards, and put him on the road while there's still light. They took Garrick out. He did not look back. The doors boomed shut behind him, and the wolf banners stirred in the draft, and Mary stood very still in the center of the great hall and discovered that her hands had finally begun to shake. Edric crossed to her. He did not announce it to the hall. He simply took both her shaking hands in his scarred ones and held them, and bent his head close so that his words were for her alone. You didn't need me to do that, he said. You'd already done it. I only said the same thing louder. I needed you to be there while I did it, she said. There's a difference. Yes, he agreed softly. There is. The council and the courtiers were watching. Mary did not care. She had spent 6 years being careful in front of men, and she was finished with it. She stepped into the king and put her face against the fur of his mantle, and he wrapped it around her the way he had wrapped the fur in the carriage, the way she understood now he would spend the rest of his life doing, and she let her hands shake against his chest until they stopped. 3 months later, the snow was gone from the valley, and the high passes had opened, and the citadel of the Hawthorne King stood green-banked and bright in the spring. Mary sat in the king's study with the windows open to the warming air, and she was sewing. She would always be sewing. The king had offered her 100 seamstresses, and she had laughed and threaded her own needle, because her hands did not know how to be idle, and her mother lived in the humming, and she did not intend to give either of those things up for any crown. She wore the crown some days, a thin circlet of gold with a single gray stone the color of his eyes, sized small for her by a smith who had grumbled about the strangeness of a queen who wanted it light enough to forget she had it on. She forgot she had it on most days. That was the point. Wren burst in without knocking, which Mary had long ago stopped trying to teach her not to do. The girl had grown 2 inches in 3 months and lost none of her elbows. There's a whole wagon of wool come up from the valley, she announced, breathless. Edric says you can have all of it. He says, and I'm saying it the way he said it, he says, tell her the blue, because she'll pretend she doesn't want the blue and then she'll want the blue. Mary laughed. It came easily now. It came all the time now, in a way it never had in 6 years of a life she had mistaken for love. He's not wrong, she admitted. Edric came in a moment behind the girl, ducking his head under the low lintel out of a habit too tall for the doorway. He had a ledger under his arm and ink on his fingers, and the particular look he got when he had been awake too long with the business of a kingdom and had come to find her the way a man comes to a fire. He set the ledger down. He looked at her in the open window light, chestnut hair loose, needle in hand, humming a tune she did not know she was humming. "There it is," he said. "There's what?" "The hum." He came around the desk and tipped her chin up with one ink-stained finger and kissed her, unhurried, the way he did everything. "I waited 3 weeks by a cold fire for that hum. I'd have waited 30 years. "You did wait 30 years, she said. "For something." "For you," he said. "I just didn't know your name yet." Outside, the valley was greening, and the trade roads were opening, and somewhere down in Hollow Frost Crossing, a man was telling a story he hated telling because a king had promised to come looking if he stopped. And up in the citadel, in a study with the windows thrown open to spring, a seamstress who had once walked into the snow to die sat sewing in the warm, humming her mother's tune, with a circlet light enough to forget on her chestnut hair and a man beside her who had been waiting at the gate before she ever knew she needed saving. She pulled her thread through, double seam, the way she always sewed, the way that kept the cold out. "What are you making?" Edric asked. Mary smiled down at the blue wool in her lap, the same faded blue as the dress she had worn out into the snow, the dress she had kept and would always keep. "A cloak," she said, "for the next person who has to walk out into the cold, so they'll be warm until somebody comes." He sat down across from her in the spring light and watched her sew. And this time, she knew exactly who was watching and why, and she did not mind it at all.